And the next matter on for oral argument this is the decision of the Hamlin Midway Library, EAW. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument to the court with an additional 5 minutes to relater if you would like that time for rebuttal. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we are keeping track of the argument in an audio recording. You're relatively close in height to each other, but in case you're not, there's a button in front of the lectern that allows you to raise or lower it to your height at whatever is convenient to you. Counsel for relator, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
I think that'll work. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Lee Bennin from Lathrop GPM, appearing on behalf of Relator Renovate 1558 Association. The Hamlin Midway Library has been a fixture of the St. Paul community for nearly 100 years. It is the only remaining library honoring its benefactor, Henry Hale, who was a local philanthropist, lawyer, real estate investor, and even the president of the St. Paul Library Association for some time in the late 1800s. But for the last 5 years, the city has worked to destroy this library without explaining why it will not simply renovate it. More than that, the city has consistently opposed anything that would preserve the library and delay demolition. The EAW at issue in this appeal is the latest chapter in that saga. The city yet again does not explain itself. The EAW, including the city's decision not to order an EIS, is arbitrary and capricious for four reasons. First, the city's plans to mitigate the historic damage caused by demolition are not subject to oversight by an ongoing public regulatory authority. That's a mouthful, so I'll just call it a regulatory authority. Second, substantial evidence does not support the city's findings that the historic damage caused by demolition can, in fact, be mitigated. Third, the city categorically did not analyze greenhouse gas emissions with one phase of the project, namely demolition. And third, all of these deficiencies combined with other actions surrounding this project's history show that the city exercised its will rather than its judgment in deciding not to order an EIS. So for all of these reasons, we ask that this court reverse and remand for a new EIS determination.
Counsel, isn't it fundamental, though, that an EIS requires the potential for significant environmental impact?
Yes, Your Honor, that's true.
And in the scheme of projects, this is really at the low end. It's not a nuclear power plant or a skyscraper or something like that, is it?
I take your point, Your Honor, that in the grand scheme of projects, with respect to, say, environmental effects like greenhouse gases, for example, which we'll talk about, this is in the lower end. But it is still something that has to be considered. All of these things are requirements that the EAW must analyze under the relevant rule, 4410.1700. And comparing the, particularly here, the historic value lost by demolishing this building is not so small compared to, it's not a one-to-one comparison, I should say. It's not a degree of magnitude between a small one-building project versus a large multi-complex type of project. And really, at the end of the day, the city does still need to go through all of these steps and make sure that it crosses its T's, dots its I's, and follows the procedures that are in place by MEPA for the very reason of preserving these natural resources, which includes historic resources. So to the first point on the ongoing public regulatory authority, again, this is one of those things that the RGU, in this case, the city, must consider. It's mandatory. There's one place in, I believe, in the city's brief where it sort of sounds like they suggest that it's an optional or permissive thing to analyze, but it's not. The rule says shall be considered. The definition of the regulatory authority here is really the key part to this aspect of our analysis.
I'm struggling with the distinction as to whether this is the argument best suited for this court or in the process, given our rather substantial deferential approach.
Understood, Your Honor. And so there is a district court proceeding as well that's scheduled for trial at the end of next month. It's very easy to sometimes wade into that, and I want to be clear that this is an appellate issue for this stage. with, it's really a matter of statute interpretation, whether the ongoing public regulatory authority who has to have oversight on these mitigation measures, whether that authority has the actual authority to enforce these measures. That's really what our brief lays out as far as there has to be this enforcement mechanism. We get that from the Friends of Twin Lakes case, where there was permitting and regulatory oversight, the Wattap Township case, similar type of situation. On the other side of the coin, you have CARD, which said that a private contractor was not an ongoing public regulatory authority for good reason. It was a private company versus a public office. Here, the relevant authority that the city relied on is the State Historic Preservation Office, the SHPO. And I can't find anything in the rules, regulations, statutes, anything. The city hasn't cited any authority either, showing that that office has the ability to enforce its mitigation measures and ensure that those proposed mitigation measures, are actually followed. And that's why we think that it's really a matter of statutory interpretation and why it is something within this court's gamut, if you will.
But relying on the SHPO is different than having the SHPO actually do the enforcement. The city is the one that can enforce things, and why can't they rely on what the SHPO, their investigation of this whole thing?
The city certainly can, and actually by rule has to consult with SHPO. We fully acknowledge that. There's a difference between consulting and having the ability to enforce the mitigation measures. And that's the key distinction in this case. The city could perhaps, through a permitting process, there's a section in the city's brief that talks about the permitting process. I don't see anything in this record showing that there's a permit tied to these historic preservation and, mitigation efforts. Things like putting up that interpretive panel in the library, which is insufficient for a reason we'll talk about in a little bit, but then there's also the Minnesota historical property records with pictures and videos and looking at other buildings in the area. Those are all well and good, but there's no way to actually enforce compliance with that and actually keeping this display up in the future. And that's one of these things that really looking at the overall scheme of MEPA supports our interpretation of this ongoing public regulatory authority language. MEPA requires that these steps are taken to actually preserve the environment, not just for now, but down the road as well. And absent an enforcement mechanism to make sure that these measures are complied with, there's no way to guarantee that.
Could the city enforce it?
Sure, through a permitting option. But again, I don't see that there's anything in this record actually tying the SHPO's mitigation recommendations to a permitting process. In the brief and in the EAW itself and in the record of decision, the city has consistently said that it will agree to follow these recommendations and implement them. But again, it's lacking that enforcement next step that we submit is required under the statute. This is sort of akin to in CARD, where there was the contractor that said, we promise not to dig down more than 25 meters or yards or whatever it was. The Supreme Court in that case adopted this court's prior holding that an RGU can't rest, an EIS determination on mitigation that is only vague statements of good intentions. And we think that distilled down means good intentions aren't enough. There still has to be an actual authority requiring and enforcing compliance with these measures. Moving on to the second point of our argument as far as the sufficiency of the mitigation measures, understanding that this is a highly deferential standard of review to the city, we still think that it has to be premised on really the undisputed fact that there is an adverse effect here by demolishing this entire building. There will be some lumber or bricks that are salvaged, but really the building is gone. And as a result of that, the mitigation measures actually, and this is straight from CARD, have to be specific and targeted and certain to mitigate the environmental effects. So as I mentioned before, the SHPO recommended the interpretive panel, this historical property records to be archived and stored, essentially. What's interesting about this piece is the recommendation from SHPO initially started out as level one Minnesota historical property records. That's the most complete type of archival historic records that there are. In the actual EAW, it changed to level two, which is supposed to be a brief and concise record of the property. So a real brief description of the property, its history, and things like that. So somewhere along the line, it changed from a level one to a level two. In Exhibit 14, in the record, there is a letter from SHPO during this whole process over the summer of last year, I forget the exact date now, where the SHPO changed its recommendation to level two. We fully acknowledge that that is in the record. But what's lacking in the record is an explanation of why that change was made. There's no explanation in the EAW, the SHPO's letter, anything like that. The SHPO simply said, after consulting with the city, we're recommending this. They didn't even acknowledge that it was a change from the prior level one records that they previously offered or recommended. It was just, here's the level two. That's our recommendation. And that lack of an explanation is one element of this that lends itself towards the decision being arbitrary and capricious not to require an EIS. One other thing worth mentioning here, in its brief, the city mentions mitigation by reusing bricks and lumber from the existing library. Again, understand that that can be one way to maybe hold on to some historical aspect of this building, but the SHPO said itself that that does not qualify as mitigation under the rules and statutes. So that's, frankly, irrelevant for this portion of the analysis. And then as far as the last mitigation measure offered by SHPO, the SHPO recommended to look at other buildings in the area and see if they are eligible to be listed on the National Register. It's unclear how that is tied to Mr. Hale's legacy when he was the St. Paul Library Association president for a while and things of that nature. We don't know if there are any other buildings that are related to Mr. Hale. In fact, there was a different library that was also demolished in the 90s. So this is the last one that is actually in his name, in his memoriam. Moving on to greenhouse gas emissions, this is really just a categorical error in the EAW. The city's proposed project has three basic points that it should analyze greenhouse gases at. The operation of the current building, the greenhouse gases to be emitted during demolition, and then the energy efficiency and greenhouse gas emissions of the new building. So point A, point B, point C. The city's greenhouse gas emission goes from point A to point C, but never discusses point B. There's nothing in the record showing that it actually considered what the harmful effects would be of demolishing the building. And that's a significant aspect of this entire project. There are some references in the city's briefing about how greenhouse gases associated with demolition would be approximately the same as renovating. I don't see any support for that in the record either. It's not in the chart that's in the EAW. I frankly don't know where that's coming from. And that's really it on that portion, Your Honors. As far as the last piece that we have, which sort of couples all of these things together, the danger signals. As this court noted in the Owatonna case from 2004, a combination of danger signals can indicate that the RGU has not actually taken a hard look at the salient problems and engaged in reasoned decision-making. In that case, there were issues with the scientific modeling process, the analysis from that process, and then the RGU rejecting the relator's concerns in a conclusory manner, quote-unquote. That's somewhat analogous to here, where there are issues with the underlying process, which we'll talk about in a moment, the analysis, which is just completely lacking in this case, and as we'll also talk about, the not addressing every category or type of comment that was submitted. So as far as those public comments, there were dozens of comments received. There were greenhouse gas concerns, demolition is very carbon intensive, There were historical preservation concerns, as we've talked about, and there are also questions about the accuracy and completeness of the EAW. The city responded in a 7-page chart, lumping these comments together into categories. There was no response about the concern about demolition carbon emissions, again, just comparing the existing buildings as they would be. And there was no discussion about whether the information in the EAW was itself factually accurate. And if that underlies this entire problem here. If the underlying information, as stated in the EAW, is inaccurate, that necessarily affects whether there should be an EIS or not. We also spent some time in our brief discussing the history of the project.
Council, let me ask you, is the city obligated to respond to every comment it receives?
Not every comment, Your Honor, but every substantive comment. And in our position, the comments questioning the accuracy and completeness of the facts as stated in that environmental worksheet, those are substantive. I see my time is up. May I briefly conclude?
Certainly.
On rebuttal, I'll discuss the history of this property being put on the National Register. But for all of these reasons, we do ask that this court reverse and remand for a new EIS determination. Thank you.
And you will indeed have 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. Daniel Staley, Stahley, Assistant City Attorney for the City of St. Paul. May it please the court. Council, this appeal concerns a project that was identified by the City of St. Paul to demolish the old Hamlin Midway Library to construct a modern and more efficient usable library on the same site. Under EQB rules, the RGU must determine if environmental review is necessary. In this case, the property has historic designation, so the RGU conducted an EAW. The RGU actually hired Blondo Consulting to do a lot of the analysis for us and to put that analysis so that we could make the proper findings of fact. Under Minnesota Statute 116.04, Subdivision 1A, Paren C, an EAW is defined as a brief document that's meant to set out basic facts to determine whether or not an EIS is necessary. In this case, the City of St. Paul, their EAW was 27 pages long. It included an additional 63 pages of exhibits, including the Blondo analysis. They addressed all of the requirements and all the analysis that was required to be made under the rules to come to its findings. The library has currently been closed since COVID because it has an antiquated HVAC system. It doesn't have an air exchanger, so it gets really dank and musty in the building. There's also significant foundation problems and water intrusion with the existing building. The plan was to actually start construction right around now, that was the initial plan. Due to environmental reviews and appeals, it'll probably take another year that the residents of Hamlin Midway will go without a library until these additional issues can be resolved. The issue being appealed here today is whether or not the negative declaration issued by the City of St. Paul was appropriate. At the conclusion of the EAW, there's findings of fact that were made and analysis that was made, and ultimately the City of St. Paul determined that a more detailed EIS was not necessary. So that's kind of the issue, kind of what happens if the court reverses here. It doesn't stop the project. It just means we have to go back for additional analysis. And kind of based on my comments previous, I think we've already done what additional environmental review can be done in this case, because it was much more significant than I think a typical EAW does. Very important in this case is the standard of review. The standard of review is the court must determine whether or not the RGU acted arbitrarily and capriciously.
Council, let me ask you about the regulatory authority question. Your opposing counsel says that you need actual enforcement authority in order to rely on the SHPO. How do you respond to that? And you know, as it is now, there is no teeth behind what the SHPO has recommended.
Sure. Council's referring to the one of the four criteria that we're required to analyze under Minnesota Rule 4410.1700, and I believe it's Subdivision 7.3, the third factor. The third factor in this case requires us to have ongoing regulatory authority. In addition to the approval by SHPO, which is statutorily required and mandated that was complied with, there's numerous permits that we addressed in the UAW. There's permits from the state of Minnesota, permits from the Metropolitan Council, permits from, there was the permit from SHPO that's already been approved. That's the only one that's already been approved, but the other ones are all ongoing. The city of St. Paul will issue numerous permits. The St. Paul Regional Water Service, there's going to be probably 20 or 30 permits that need to be issued, plus site plan review for this project to move forward. Those are all the ongoing regulatory authorities that are contemplated and were analyzed by the city of St. Paul in its findings of fact. The fact is the SHPO analysis is done at the front end of it by statute, and it's Minnesota Statute 138.665, Subdivision 2. The RGU is required to consult with SHPO to identify proper mitigation. In this case, we suggested proper mitigation. The proper mitigation suggested by the city was to retain the archway, to retain some of the lumber and the wood floors into the new building, and to use a lot of the brickwork to make an outdoor garden at the new facility, kind of a reading space outdoors. SHPO said that's not sufficient. We couldn't go forward with the project. Actually, the statute requires the RGU and SHPO come to a meeting of the minds, and SHPO's, their response is, well, you need to do more than what you suggested. SHPO suggested additional guidelines that were additionally agreed to by the city of St. Paul. They, you know, discussed previously the documentation and filing with Minnesota Historical Society. I think one of the important ones is the construction of a living memorial inside of the library to address the historical neighborhood and the demolished library, so that the children have an opportunity to learn about the Hamlin Midway neighborhood in general, but also specifically this library. There'll be an interactive display.
But so, on the regulatory authority issue, I guess your response to sum up is permits are coming. They're
yes.
just not here yet. And is that sufficient to meet the statutory burden here?
It is. There needs to be ongoing regulatory review, and that is accomplished by all of the standard permits that are that always go along with the construction process. The only permit that we later discussed was the SHPO permitting, and that just happens to be one that we've already done the review, and they've already agreed to a plan. That plan has been put in place, and that'll be part of this project. The other ongoing review has to come with the St. Paul Regional Water Services, Metropolitan Council, the Minnesota Department of Health. There are numerous departments and agencies. I think we needed approval from even the Army Corps of Engineers. Lots of different regulatory review that goes forward with any project.
Council, the appellants claim you didn't address all the comments that would have occurred at the public hearing or maybe in writing. Do you have a response to that?
I would just disagree with that. I think if you look at one of the exhibits to the UAW, we put forth a chart. You know, there were numerous comments. They were broken down into 10 or 11 different categories of comments. So we identified every concern and addressed every concern in a written comment.
What do we make of the idea of the greenhouse gas emissions where demolition, opposing counsel's arguing the demolition was skipped. You went from A to C without the B portion of that.
Sure. So, I mean, we know that greenhouse gas emissions will be lower with the new building. There was a greenhouse gas analysis that was performed as part of the Blondo consulting report. The findings, in that report, there was also notes that the vast majority of greenhouse gases that are released during demolition come from the foundation of the building. In this case, much of the foundation will have to be replaced anyways. It'll have to be demolished.
That's my question, is the demolition portion. Under the EAW, it says that it's unknown, and that's the greenhouse gas emission analysis for demolition. Is there more studies that could be done, or is unknown sufficient?
That's all we're aware of. I guess we hired the consultant to study this issue, and they determined that was an unknown facet. I think focusing on the fact that the new building will lower greenhouse gas emissions by 90% over the useful life of the library was kind of the analysis they made, and that was the analysis that was adopted by the RGU.
And if I understand you correctly, you're suggesting that even without demolition, if there's repair, the record would show essentially greenhouse gases are a problem as well, on par with demolition?
I think it's too difficult to determine without, you know, the building's deteriorating as we sit here today, and the... If we were to go to the remediation phase, it's unknown how much of the foundation, if not all of the foundation, would have to be destroyed anyways. I guess the comment from, or it's my understanding that there was an inspector that was recently in the building and went into the basement and kind of would touch the walls of the basement, and water would kind of run down the walls. It's unknown, because it's unknown how much of the foundation would need to be replaced and repaired. And much of the, like I said, the bricks to the building are going to be reused. Over 75% of the materials are going to be reused. That was part of our analysis. A lot of the lumber is going to be reused, the archway, and just it's impossible to determine how much would have been released in greenhouse gases, depending on the current state of the, we don't have, by the time they actually have to go through and start building this, they might have to demolish the entire foundation and kind of raise it from scratch there, because that's where a lot of the damage is to this building.
Just realistically, a decades-old library is not in any way similar to a modern library, is it?
I'm sorry, what's that?
A decades-old library would not be similar at all to a modern library. I mean, you don't have as many books anymore.
Sure. So part of the reason that the RGU determined that the new library was required is because there's going to be a loud room for children to play. There's going to be a teenage room for teenagers to interact. There's going to be two community rooms that are all separate so that the community can meet. And so we can have a useful space. As I understand now, most of the space is in the basement, which is not very useful. And there's no quiet spaces, so it's difficult to have community meetings there. Or some of the other major reasons why the RGU determined that a rebuild was appropriate in this case. What other additional? Yeah, there's technological upgrades. I don't think there's really Wi-Fi capabilities or plug-in capabilities at any of the stations at the current library, and the new one would be completely state-of-the-art, up to date with to be able to log onto the internet and have all the Wi-Fi capabilities that I think most patrons would come to expect and appreciate now. And also, I guess the biggest reason was that the former building's not handicap accessible. The new building will be completely handicap accessible, so everyone in the community will have the opportunity to enjoy the building, whereas right now, not everybody's able to use this library. I guess moving on to my argument, there are mandatory cases where what we're dealing here is whether or not we needed to have additional review to delay the project further. or whether or not the 27-page review and analysis was already that was already done was appropriate. The mandatory cases where there are where an EIS is required, you know, again, are nuclear power plants, petroleum refining, industrial complexes in excess of 1.5 million square feet, hazardous waste facilities, housing redevelopments greater than 1,500 units. You know, what we're talking about here is a one-story library with a basement that has water intrusion that's, you know, being replaced by another library on the same site. I just don't think that this is the type of case that warrants an EIS. And again, there are four factors that the RGU is required to consider in making its determination. That's under 4410.1700 subdivision 7. The RGU analyzed all four factors. They made findings of fact on all four factors, and they came to the ultimate conclusion that there's not a potential for significant environmental impact. That's the standard, and the court has to give deference to that standard. They have to give deference to the findings of fact. They have to presume them to be accurate. I guess I'll go through. I'm kind of running out of time here, but there are four factors, and all of them were addressed. Again, historic preservation is more than old bricks. It's about, you know, teaching children about history with interactive displays. It's about having a valuable meeting space that the community can actually use. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any rebuttal? And just a reminder to restate your name for the record.
Will do. May it please the court, counsel. Lee Benin from Lathrop GPM on behalf of Relator, Renovate 1558 again. A few points to hit on rebuttal. The first, sort of this general theme of the current inadequacies of the current library, that's one of those things that's really more at issue in the district court case. There's no dispute here that the library does need to be fixed up if it's not rebuilt. But again, that's not really what's at issue here. At issue in this appeal is the EAW and the sufficiency of the EAW. Even so, I would be remiss if I didn't note, the city's developer that it hired to come up with these alternative plans for this library did come up with a renovation option that met all of its goals. So renovation is at least an option. As far as the regulatory authority section of our argument, I don't see in the record a reference to an SHPO permit. There's the recommendations that the SHPO gave to the city, but on Exhibit 2, page 10, there's a chart of permits and approvals required, and there are permits from the Minnesota Department of Health, Metro Council, Environmental Services, Pollution Control Agency, City of St. Paul. These are all things like building permits, site plan reviews, right-of-way permits. I don't see anything in the record about an SHPO permit. As far as what I said I was going to get to, the history and circumstances surrounding the library being placed on the National Register of Historic Places, initially the SHPO concurred with the nomination to the National Register. SPPL, the St. Paul Public Libraries, they objected at a historic preservation meeting, and then the HPC for some reason took no position at the meeting and instead sent it to the SHPO review board, the nomination to the National Register for review. In the interim, the city mayor sent a letter to SHPO over the Heritage Preservation Commission's objection, saying that the nomination was not properly before the review board and that the HPC voted not to support the nomination, which was just not true based on the actual record of those meetings. And in fact, that's what the keeper of the National Register at the federal level later found and then ordered the SHPO to actually review the nomination, which was quickly approved locally and then at the federal level. And then even after that, the city didn't start the EAW process, which is really what we're here for today, until March 2023, after citizens petitioned the EQB, the Environmental Quality Board, I believe it is, to order the city to prepare one because it was a mandatory EAW project since it affects a property listed on the National Register of Historic Places. So then starting in March 2023, the city started the EAW process. And then, as I understand it from the record, the city actually closed the library for demolition in May of 2023, a few weeks before the EAW was issued. The question is why? Why would it close the library to demolish before it even knew whether it needed to take additional steps in the EIS? I just don't know why. That's the thing that keeps on ringing in my head throughout this entire case is why is the city so opposed to renovating and objecting to things along the way that would make it require more work to actually go through the steps, make sure that renovation and the environment and the historical aspects of this building are preserved. That's something that I still have questions about even after today. If there are no further questions from the court, I'll save the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to both counsel for your thorough and careful briefing and your oral argument today. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period.